Talking about Augustine, how in Augustine's system of theology is it decided who will be saved and who will be lost? Seven.
Well, God determines that by whomever He bestows His grace.
Okay. Predestined by God. Can anyone elect it to be saved, be lost, and can anyone not elect it?
No.
No way to cross over. And of course, where's that held? Question 10, where's that held now? Where's that view held now?
Where?
Yeah, what groups?
Calvinists.
Yeah, anybody that follows Calvin.
Most Protestants.
And in fact, as we've been talking about with Augustine and with the two Pelagius and Augustinian systems, the Catholic Church actually, while it takes some of the foundational beliefs came from it, and those carry through to the Reformation, it's really in the Reformation that Augustine's theology gets the real full treatment and acceptance.
He said to some degrees, and more and less degrees, depending on which denominational group you're talking about.
Oh, yeah.
Some of your Baptists have held on to it lock, stock, and barrel. Some of your Baptists hold on to one of the latter ends that you can't fall away. They might not agree on some of the other tenets, but they'll hold on to the theory.
Right.
You can't lose it once you've got it.
And probably a lion's share, can't make that statement. I suspect a lot of people who happen to be in denominations where the Calvinism is the foundation, if you'd say, do you know you believe in Calvinistic theology, they'd say, huh? And they don't make that connection at all. It's just not taught that way. Okay, number 11. How does the Roman Catholic Church agree with Augustine? How does it disagree? Maybe the easiest thing to do is say, how does it disagree?
Yeah,
they believe in the Trinity. Although, really, Augustine did too. He gave it, so they agree with that. They agree with Trinity. Yeah, all the Catholic Church does, yes. Augustine, he got accused of that. But in fact, he, in his writings, he really laid out Trinitarianism. It's just because of some of the things that he was confronted with and the way he would respond to them, people would accuse him of being a modalist, or at least leaning that way.
The Catholic Church didn't believe in predestination.
They do not believe in predestination.
Right.
And,
right.
And they don't believe in irresistible grace. In other words, man has a will and he's free to exercise it in some degree. I'll use the term, I think, prevenient grace, which grace that comes before, preceding grace. They do believe in a preceding grace, but that your will has a part to play. God does not zap you, in effect. But you do have to have God's grace to assist, is the best way I know how to describe it, in assist your will in doing things that are right. Question 12, I read that about 10 times, and I'm not sure. It reads like somebody that's never taken English wrote it. Basically, the question number 12 is, when you look at Augustine's view of administering baptism and some of the other sacraments of the church, relative to the character of the one doing the act, that is, the priest or whatever, what was his view?
It affects the godliness or the purity of the one doing the baptizing.
Does or does not affect it?
Does not affect it.
Right. And, you know, would you agree with that?
Yeah.
I'll
believe it. Sure.
So in that he's right, and you would agree that baptism is a sacrament?
No,
you wouldn't hear that part of it, which is the view he had. And relative to number 14, relative to that, sacraments, why would that be important in all what was already a corrupt Catholic Church?
was.
Yeah, it was necessary.
The Spirit had come through the church, gave more power, more.
Exactly. Gave the church more power. The sacraments were required for salvation, and the church, the Catholic Church, held that power to deliver that. Pelagius, what did he believe about human free will and sin?
That man had a free will.
Okay, and also, that's correct. Man had free will. Will. What about sin?
Well, he wasn't burdened with that sin of Adam.
He wasn't burdened with the sin of Adam.
He could live without sin.
He could live without sin. He could live under the law perfectly, his view. Under the law of God, whatever the law of God that was in play. And somebody's already answered number 21. What did he believe about original sin? And he didn't believe that man inherited sin from Adam. Lesson 9. Go back to the questions in lesson 9 real quickly. What role, all the way down to number 5, what role did Lerns, Vincent, said Lerns, but it's really Vincent, give the Catholic Church in determining truth in his writings?
That it was a source.
It was, right. It was guardian. It was a source. It was the guardian of truth. Either way. And he had a rule for determining God's will. And you can write this, you can answer this different ways. And what is, I'll see if I can get to the answer I'm looking for by the question. Number 6, what was his rule for determining God's will? And was teaching of Scripture taken into account in that? Number 6.
Well, I thought it would be the teaching of Scripture was interpreted by the Catholic Church.
Okay, that's true.
He did try to substantiate it by Scripture.
The thing about it, though, what he said was, in the final analysis, the church is really the determination, and it supersedes the Scriptures. And, that would be the conclusion. Right. And that really answers number 7. And Vincent, could the Catholic Church ever err in his teaching? And I mean, how can you err in your teaching?
But his idea for doing that is something that, you wouldn't look at and say, man, that's a crazy idea. Because his reasoning process was that, if you get 1,000 men together, you're going to get 1,000 interpretations. We got to be able to stand united, one teaching, and it needs to be united throughout. I mean, that's what Christ prayed for in John 17.
I'll be one.
And so, so we can't make up our minds. We'll just have the church,
good
be one
of us. Right.
It's not far out thinking, once you start that path.
Is it a problem today? Is it a problem in...
Well, yeah, people don't do their own study.
Yeah. Is that a risk here?
What do the elders teach?
See, I mean, it's orthodoxy. That's a problem we have today, right here in Texas, without any problem, and a lot of other places, among brethren of Christ. And that's the risk. And Mike's point's well made. And the answer to the question, people don't study. Where do we get our, where do we get our authority? And you don't get it from me. You don't get it from all of us voting on it. You get it from the Word of God. And we're going to have to stand and fall on that. Quickly, 9 and 11, we've got these two compromising views that develop. One is what's called semi-Pelagianism. So number 9, what was just in summary, what's the influence by that, their conclusion, what was the influence of Adam's sin on men? Okay, I'll give you a quick...
It
weakened man, but at the same time, man did inherit Adam's sin. Semi-Pelagianism, just like semi-Augustinianism, is an attempt to compromise, really, these views.
It's two separate compromises.
It's two separate compromises. One favors Augustine, one favors Pelagius. But they're a mix. I mean, they're not pure either sin. And so Adam's original sin is inherited, but as Mike says, it weakened the will. But at the same time, what did man have it? Did man have a free will by that theology?
I think by the semi-Pelagianism, he did have a free will.
Right, he did. And predestination? Remember what Pelagius, if you have a free will, can you be predestined?
Is
the question.
Don't ask this to rationalize it,
will you? The talking and the thinking. The reason I wanted to go back and go over these is it gets confusing. I mean, it kind of gets in a mishmash. And you start off with, here's Augustine, here's Pelagius. And you remember, one of these is really an attempt to compromise toward the Pelagius end, but it's not Pelagius 100%. The other one's toward the Augustinian end, and it's not Augustinian 100%.
We want to keep the free will, but dependent upon the church.
Yes. They still, in fact, I asked that, that's number 12. In spite, and you can say this in either case, what was the major concern of what I call churchmen and their disagreement with Augustine? And Jim just answered the question. They wanted to keep the power with the church. And if you say it, you say you're predestined, you have no will, God's already decided, what's the point?
Yeah.
See? What do you need the church for? With semi-Augustinism, and semi-Augustine view, what's influence of Adam's sin was still death and sin through Adam. It was inherited sin. Free will of man, and this is really... They probably more than the other came to the weakened will approach. Again, remember, this is ultimately going to be a view of the Catholics, and that is that man has a weakened will. You need prevenient grace to help that will, but you still have freedom of will. It's just weak. Okay, it's not strong.
Well,
yes.
Today, for those who hold Calvinism in more of its fullest of its tenets, such as Presbyterians, do they teach more the rewards of this life, or do they teach the rewards of heaven predominantly?
I don't, Mike, I can't remember. I have to go back and look.
It'd be difficult, it seems like, with that belief set, to really teach the reward of heaven very fervently. It would have to be what's in it for you in this life.
Well, there's a yes and no. Yes, they have a predisposition to salvation, and they can't, that can't be taken away from them. But I think they were still a predestination. But it's still, and I don't know what's meant to them, but still there's the view, what's the point of that if you don't have a reward? And what's the point of predestined to what? Well, it's got to be because that's up. Now, whether or not they preach that a lot,
But I mean, it's not that all these people that's predestined to heaven gravitated toward the Presbyterian Church.
Oh, no.
Is that a part of the predestination that they go... They meet there at the corner of Elm and Maple, So, you would think that the scope of the audience would be not predestined. So what's their interest in being there?
Now you get into, from a historical standpoint, now you get into how do they set, what's the organization?
What they don't know.
What do we offer today? I mean, today, and I'm not going back when it was set up, but today it is... And you just look up and down the street. What's the main attraction today? Is it the theology?
It's this life.
It's the social side of it. Yeah. And that's where it's evolved to.
They all always have life centers.
I'm trying to get from the standpoint of where they start from, in terms of what they were pushing in their early life versus where it's evolved to, there's a big difference between those two, in, if nothing else, in terms of emphasis today. And I think that's true with a lot of the denominations today. They've got to deal with the here and now. But the here and now, you know, and drawing people into the social things, why, what's the reason? And I don't understand this with respect to, there is no logic. There's no rationale if you're predestined, in my mind, if you're predestined for anybody to waste their time attending church, being involved in that kind of
but
stuff.
But nobody knows who those people are.
They don't. Well, they don't know, but they think they are. So, well, I mean, you know, how are they motivated? Yeah. And so do they really believe it? It's another matter. But you, what the, what's the pull of the social gospel? What's the idea?
It's the whole man concept.
Yeah, all right.
It just appeals to you.
But ultimately, what are they trying to do? Oh, look, what's the bus ministry all about among churches of Christ?
Increase numbers.
Yeah. It is to increase numbers, but I'll give them the benefit of the motivation. They want to have people come in the doors so we can preach the gospel to them and convert them. So it depends on the group whether or not they, that motivation is high and the means are unauthorized, or whether it's a case of they just want to have a good time. And I don't, you know, that almost probably changes group by group, probably. But you're, you know, don't try to, don't, as you said a moment ago, don't confuse me with trying to explain the rationale for it. I mean, some of these things are they're unrational to me.
It just seems like, though, when you've got a group of people and you don't know which one's predestined, which one's not, you know, there is some ability to do good, like, you know, you answered, brought out that answer a few classes back. You know, why preach heaven when the majority of them don't ever get there? It doesn't make sense to do that.
I suspect, and somebody else in the class may have this experience, I have not, I can't say I've ever asked this question and gotten an answer, but I suspect those who participate in any of this, A, believe they are the elect, and B, if they understand the theology, B, would say they're elect because they feel God's grace and God's Spirit working in them. They look at how they have behaved. It's a little bit like Augustine. They look at how they have behaved, how their life has changed, and they have to come to the conclusion thereby that they have the grace of God working on them. That's through the Spirit. That's the way I think they would get there. And so you talk to anybody in a, you know, that's an active body in Baptist Church, Presbyterian Church, whatever church, I suspect they're going to give you that kind of view if they really got down to how do you theologically answer it.
A testimonial approach.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, no question
so
about it.
How they feel.
Oh, it is. You know, a lot of it is.
Spirit speaks to my heart and these kinds of things.
Exactly. I've got a cousin that, I mean, you can't have a conversation with him without that just overwhelming you. Okay, so let's go. I think I probably just covered the point I wanted to cover back on. I do want to read something to you. If you go back to lesson, just the last page of lesson 9, or I don't have page numbers. It starts with B. It's B3, B2, excuse me. Council of Orange. Council of Orange. I read these chapter headings, which I just wanted to give you a feel for it. Let me tell you what they concluded. This synod came up with a creed, like most of them do, and this represents. This actually would end up representing, according to Pope Gregory, what true Augustinism, what Augustine's views and how they wanted to incorporate it really was. Anyway, their creed is, through the fall, free will has been so weakened that without prevenient grace, no one can love God, believe on him, or do good for God's sake as he ought. In other words, it's not irresistible, but you still have to have it, okay? Through the grace of God, all may, by the cooperation of God, perform what is necessary for their soul's salvation so they can exercise their will. It is by no means our faith, that is, their system of faith, their belief, doctrine that any have been predestined by God to sin, but rather if anybody believes that, they're condemned. In every good work, the beginning proceeds not from us, but God inspires in us faith and love to him without merit precedent on our part, so that we desire baptism and after baptism can with his help fulfill his will. So prevenient grace comes in, your will is active, but still you need that grace from God to have you to perform. Okay, and that's basically the view that the Augustine Gregory took and declared this was truth coming out of this synod. I say Pope Gregory. I mean at this point, and I find myself doing this. Pope Gregory by Catholic Church rewrite of history. Who was the first pope? Really? Boniface III, 607, I think. And yet, when you read Catholic, anything you read, in fact, it's even in secular history, it's been infiltrated. They view these men as popes, and they're really what they are, bishops of Rome at the time. And the last point, the last 2 points, A and B, I think are key, and that is that in the final analysis, the church had to come to the conclusion that predestination was a doctrine to be avoided, to be condemned. Because if it's predestination,
don't need the church.
Don't need the church. Do away with it. Okay? And so it's a very logical, political idea.
This idea that the council rejected the idea of irresistible grace.
Uh-huh.
Well, wasn't that one of Augustine's tenets?
Yes, they rejected that.
So they rejected some of Augustine as well as rejecting both Pelagianism and semi-Pelagianism.
That's correct. In their entirety, they condemned them. But what happened is, what's happening here is, Augustine set a basis, and one of the fundamental aspect of Augustine to the Catholic became the idea of inherited sin. Sin inherited from Adam then sets the basis for why they have baptism of infants. The degree to which man has got to have a mediator between him and God. Okay, so it's sort of a foundational belief.
Are the Catholics still teaching the doctrine of Limbo?
No, I'll probably cover that a little bit when we get into it. No, is the answer. And there's
are they teaching the doctrine of purgatory?
Yes.
Yes.
And those go.
I found it interesting at this last funeral, the priest said that this person. I don't know if you use Abraham's bosom, that terminology or not, but I was thinking if they taught the doctrine of purgatory, then there must have been the purchasing of some indulgence or something, because this person's already in Abraham's bosom or in heaven instead of being in purgatory. Only been a day or two or three, So I was a little confused as to their doctrine.
Yeah.
Of course, it's not a doctrine they would spout out to get people to say it was purgatory.
No. I don't think so. But that's like limbo. Limbo is not actually a Catholic.
I think they dropped that one.
Yeah, they have. And it's not actually, the thing that comes out about that is it's not actually a doctrine as in, it's taught. It's been taught forever, but it's not an official doctrine of the Catholic. It never has been an official doctrine of the Catholic Church, even though it's been a doctrine of the Catholic Church. It's not on the same plane as purgatory, which is in fact a doctrine. Okay, and that y'all are experts in that. Lesson 10 and 11 is going to deal with, I call it the apostate church and its doctrine. It really deals with the church of the Catholic Church in the period of the Middle Ages primarily. And we're going to come at this several different ways. Some of the time we'll actually go back in history a little bit. Before the Middle Ages, just in brief. because there's certain things that overlap, certain developments that happen, they overlap in time. And you'll see that, you may see that as we go through this. And then we'll talk, particularly in Lesson 11, we talk about the sacraments, which are, you know, kind of the heart of the Catholic Church doctrines. A little bit of an overview, just you know, this first part, really the history of the church in the Middle Ages would be the Western Church, the Roman Church. The Eastern Church was dominated really by politics, and so had very little doctrinal significance. The church was actively missionary, active in missionary work. And by the way, as I talk about this, when I use the term church, it'll be, although the schism, the official schism comes later, comes in this period, it's later in our discussion. And so most of the time we're talking about Bishop of Rome in here, or ultimately the Pope. So anyway, they were active in missionary work. Remember, there's geopolitical changes going on during this time. We are in the end, we're going to go back a little bit, but the Roman Empire, the Western Empire, kind of officially goes away on 476 AD. And so you got things that have been happening even when Constantine's around. They're geopolitical in nature. And that impacts, however, even though they're conquerors and that kind of thing, invaders, it interacts with the Roman Church and it helps really develop where it ends up. As these invasions happen, you end up having interaction going on. The Roman emperor steps down, in effect, or is minimized, and you see the church step in, the leadership of the church step in. They start to interact, they start to convert, they start to get even more wealthy, and they start to get more corrupt as a result of that. And so as you go through this period of time, by the time we hit the end of the Middle Ages, the doctrine in the Catholic Church has been set. And the only thing that really was to come, the major points, the only thing that really was to come was in 1870 with the Vatican Council, where they declared the infallibility of the Pope. During this period, just to give you an idea, the Catholic doctrine developed, some terms you're going to recognize, purgatory, we just talked about it, that was 593, prayer to Mary, saints, and angels happened in 600. This was a new one to me, although probably shouldn't be. I've seen it, kissing hands. Kissing the Pope's foot came in 709. Rocky, when did you leave the Catholic Church? Yeah. I mean, has it been, were you a little kid or were you up?
25.
Okay. Did you ever see, I guess I've not seen this, practice of kissing the Pope's foot?
I never saw it.
It happens.
Pope, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Hand,
I remember.
Hands.
Usually it's hands.
I've seen it in newsreels.
Okay, I've just missed out on that one. Canonization of dead saints, 995, celibacy of the priesthood, 1079, rosary, 1090, substantiation, confessing sins to a priest in 1215, and seven sacraments in 1439. This is kind of the development. These probably came along, although I don't document each of them, came along in the course of some kind of council or other things that would bring them about, like Gregory's activities on a couple of them, on one of them anyway, purgatory. The period also saw what's called scholasticism, and you may recognize this name, Thomas Aquinas. They did get themselves, they did train up people, or people were trained up to be scholars and try to come at a faith or defend a faith from a rational view. But also other things started to evolve and grow, and certainly the moving away from Augustine was one of those. Works became an important part of salvation and sanctification, and we'll see the authority of the papacy increases in the course of this time. Most of us, I guess, are familiar or have heard the term the rise and fall of the Roman Empire. A lot of people have written books about the fall of the Roman Empire, and there are a lot of reasons why it fell that people focus in on. With the Roman Empire, and here again we're talking about the Western Empire, the immediate cause was actually Germanic invasion. I mean, that's what brought it about. Germanic tribes, the barbarians invading from the north. My ancestors, they would come down. And, you know, the groups like these groups you'll recognize by probably Goths, Vandals. Get our word vandalism. Gives you an idea what kind of tribe that was. Burgundians, Lombards were some of them. And probably the most important with the Goths, and there's another, the western branch of that, called the Visigoths. And the Visigoths, actually going back to 271, so we're stepping back in time again, they took over a province of empire, Dacia, or Dacia, and that's how they got introduced to Christianity. They took Roman prisoners who were members of the church, and they did the converting of their captors. And it turned out there's a fellow, and it's not important, but there's a fellow in the name of, I think it's Ifla, who was one of the descendant of one of them, and he ended up being consecrated as head of the community by an Arian bishop. So he's in amongst the Visigoths, and he's got an Arian bishop, a bishop of Arian persuasion, that set him up as a leader. And so as a result of that, the Visigoths as a nation, or tribe, were converted to an Arian-type theology. Now remember what Arian is. Arianism believes that Christ is a created being. So that's what these people believe and what they were taught. As time went on, kind of toward the end of the 3rd century, Rome enjoyed about 100 years of peace. But then in 395, we talked about the Emperor Theodosius. He died, and he had two sons, and their names aren't important, but they split up the empire between those two. And a fellow named Alaric, who was a king of the Visigoths, typical political thing. You got two bosses where you used to have one, so he started trying to split them up, which he was doing successfully. And he eventually was encouraged by Constantinople, of all places, to invade Italy. And in 410, he did, and he invaded Rome. He sacked Rome for about 3 days. And you gotta recognize, this would be a little bit like somebody coming in and for 3 days sacking New York's, well, maybe we wouldn't be so upset about it, sacking New York City. Rome hadn't been taken over by anybody for 800 years. And so on the psyche, it had a big, big impact. It had a little permanent effect, actually, because the Visigoths sacked it and took off. And so it didn't have a lot of long-term impact on Rome itself. It was more on the psyche of the people. Then you go up in time, 452, Attila the Hun invaded, but he was persuaded to withdraw. And the thing that's important about it, and I don't know if this is true or fiction, true or myth, and that is that supposedly the Pope, Leo, is the one that came in to delegate with Attila and convinced him to leave. And, you know, if that's true, and in the next case it is true, you start to see the Pope have an impact in the worldly affairs at this time, a bigger impact. And then the Vandals came in later. They went over in north, they really went around north Spain, I'm sorry, north Africa, came from Spain, and took control around the Mediterranean on the south side, and they ruled the sea during this period of time. And then in 455, they actually attacked Rome, and Rome was pretty well shot. And again, Leo saved Rome by pleading with leader of the Vandals, Gaiseric, to restrain. He did a 14-day sack of the city, but he got him to restrain himself, And then the next couple of days, next couple of decades were just, you know, there was ongoing back and forth invasion, departure, etc. And until 476, you have this fellow, Odoacer, or however you care to pronounce it, who ended up declaring himself as the ruler of the Roman Empire. And so in 476, it's looked about as the official fall of the Roman Empire. And while you don't know what the cause, I mean, there are a number of causes, a big part of which is, if you study the history, Rome internally disintegrated, morally, ethically, legally, you name it. Roman people versus, or people would be classified as free Romans, versus the barbarians that they'd captured over the years, all kinds of reasons. But, you know, the Germans took advantage of it and destroyed the place, destroyed the empire and took control. And so that brought us to 476. So we see the disappearance of the Roman Empire as we knew it from the beginning. So you enter in a different, entering into a different phase, we'll still pick up a little bit in history, but you're really starting to see, we'll start to see more and more of the development of the Holy Roman Empire and the imperial papacy and all the things that go along with that. Gregory the Great was the Bishop of Rome between 590 and 604. Innes, you got a short piece on Gregory? Go. We'll talk about Gregory just a second.
City of Rome, about 574, he became a monk, and he founded six monasteries and families of estates in Sicily. About 578, Pope Benedict I named him as one of Rome's seven religious deacons and an important papal administrative office. From about 579 to 585, Gregory was an ambassador to the Byzantine imperial court in Constantinople. Gregory left a body of written, a variety of writings, including over 850 letters. Another source, I just picked up a few little things about it. He defeated Italy from barbarian attack, defended Italy from barbarian attack. He organized papal lands throughout Italy and Sicily and collected enough taxes to feed the Roman population and pay Roman soldiers. In the 590s, he made peace with the invading Lombard tribe, which was threatening Rome. His leadership established the temporal power of the papacy. One of the more important things, it seemed like, was that the conversion of England to Christianity was begun during his reign. And he strengthened the church in Spain, France, and northern Italy.
Okay. Back when he first started that, and then on in as you get further along, Gregory was, you heard him say, prefect of Rome, governor of Rome. And so there was his taste of the secular side. And as he moved on, that desire for power, for temporal power, did not leave him. And he is the sort of pivotal point for the papacy getting itself involved in the governing of the government, the secular side of the empire. By the way, the Byzantine empire. We talk about the Roman Empire, which is the west side. The east side was originally was part of the Roman Empire. Well, it ended up being what's called the Byzantine Empire, and it lasted till 1500s. It lasted, or 1400s. It lasted till it became the Ottoman Empire. And so we're not going to talk about it other than what I just said. A couple other things to bring out. He had his training as a lawyer. And I kind of like this one. Despite his legal acumen, he was not regarded as a scholar, nor was he ever more than a mediocre theologian. He knew none of the biblical language, had no time for pagan learning, and was not an original thinker. And I read that and I thought, that sounds like some lawyers I know. Not much different. He did believe in the verbal inspiration of the scriptures, and he thought it was just futile to try to figure out who wrote them, because the Holy Spirit was its author. You didn't need to worry about the rest of it. Mentioned he wanted to be have temporal power, and actually when the emperor abandoned Rome and all his possessions, Gregory felt obligated to step in, take over the authority, take over the possessions, and rather than leave it to anarchy. And so by the time he died in 604, and you can kind of see why Boniface would be named Pope, by the time he died in 604, he was looked upon as the chief bishop in the West. So that's part of his doings as far as giving power to the papacy. We talked about the conversions he went after. I thought it was interesting. Was it him? Oh, that comes later. Take that back. He would, these folks that would invade, or he sent missionaries out to, actually, they'd end up converting the ruler, and the ruler would convert the population. And you can imagine how that happened, because the whole population would take one step to the right, and we're now converted. And it certainly is not the way conversion happens in the Bible. He did introduce a couple of new doctrines, and I have time for these. I'm going to hit them. Penance is one. This is going to become very, very, very important. Ultimately, doing penance will lead up to the reason for the Reformation, or a reason. And so he introduced this. And the doctrine is that sin can be forgiven on the condition of repentance. But the thing that's important about that is it involves these three things: contrition, confession, and satisfaction. And the satisfaction had to be proportional to the sin. And you can substitute satisfaction for some kind of indulgence. Pay your way out somehow. And, of course, this is the system as it grew. The whole business of indulgences on top of this due penance would lead to the Reformation that occurred in Germany. We'll pick back up right there, Lord willing, Wednesday. This will be, purgatory goes hand in hand with it, by the way. And we'll try to point that out when we get together. Anybody here have any announcements? Yeah, that one I know about. Can you lock it right there? Thank you. Get this thing turned off.